Okay, good morning, Professor Sjögren. Thank you very much for joining us. The theme of this series of interviews is the ideas that surrounded spinning glasses and replica symmetry breaking writ large in a period that we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. But before we dive into that core of the subject, can you tell us a bit about yourself, in particular about your family and your studies before attaining university?
Before university.
Yes.
I come from a region of Sweden called Dalarna, but grew up in a small town called Eskilstuna, where I went on school and high school. And then I left to Göteborg and started at Chalmers University
So how
in
did you
1967. I started my studies at the university in 67, and then I started for a PhD studies in 71,
So can
and
I
I
ask
finished.
what interested you in physics in the first place? What was your right?
Roughly when I was 15, I more or less decided to be a researcher in atomic physics for some reason. I don't know why, really. It was just that it was interesting, I thought. I was interested in physics and mathematics. And at that time, of course, in the 60s, there were much ado about nuclear power and these kind of things. So I suppose this was one reason for the interest.
And then
I
what?
start, I start, I started at something called technical physics, and that education was mainly invented for the nuclear industry.
So what then led you to pursue graduate studies in theoretical physics in particular?
I don't know if I suppose that I thought it was interesting. I during the last year on my undergraduate studies, I studied a lot of theory courses like nuclear physics and such things. So it was, in a certain sense, natural for me to continue with this, I suppose.
And what drew you to then the group of Alf Sjölander to work on the kinetic theory of classical liquids?
I talked with many people at the institute, and I talked with Stig Lundqvist, Olle Brander. Maybe you heard about Stig Lundqvist. He was a very influential person in Sweden. He was the chairman of the Nobel Committee for a long period. But then Alf Sjölander had he had a very strong reputation, so I thought I should choose him. He was, so to speak, the best. And so I thought it was a challenge, you know, to see if I could make it.
So after your PhD, except for a postdoc of 1 year in Paris and a brief stint in industry, you remained at the Institute of Theoretical Physics in Chalmers as a research assistant, a RED assistant, I think. Can you describe the environment and the functioning of the statistical physics group at the Institute?
Yes, there was, except for the statistical physics, there were the solid state theory with Stig Lundqvist. And then a little bit later, also, there was a Bengt Lundqvist in surface physics. So there were three research groups. The statistical physics was rather small group, I think. Alf Sjölander did not have many students. So before me, he had, I think, three students. And after me, three or four more. So, but he didn't take many students. So but he was very active himself. So he really sat down and did calculations himself. So as a student, you got a very good help, so to speak, or he could instruct you very much. And he was interested in everything you did, which at that time was, I think, very good. Later, maybe not. He interfered, I think, too much when you wanted to become independent.
So in notes you sent us, you mentioned that you started working on spinning glasses in 1983. Where did this interest emerge? How did you first hear of spinning glasses?
It was in connection, you know, when we, as I wrote in this note, we studied liquids, and in particular on the long time tails in the memory function. And then we started to discuss glasses in general, you know, and at the time, spin glasses was a very hot topic. So I know that Alf Sjölander himself wanted to study regular glasses, supercooled liquids and regular glasses. So I thought that if you want to study glasses, spin glasses is a good subject.
So you would have heard of the topic from the literature or from conferences or seminar speakers?
In the literature, then we had certain guests who also were interested in spin glasses. Marek Szczeplak, if you know him, from Poland. So I had some discussion with him. Later, of course, we also talked with John Hirsch from Nordita, but that was maybe 84 or 85, something like that. But there was a lot of activity in these years, so this is one reason.
Okay. In 1983, Professor Goetze came to Chalmers on a sabbatical. Do you know what drew him to Chalmers in particular?
I think he wanted to study glasses simply, and we had contact with Goetze maybe in 73. He visited us for a talk. You know, he was also, well, he had since long studied liquids, and then he started to study the metal isolated transition in and then he went over to the what is it called, Lorentz model, the classical Lorentz model, where you have a particle in a fixed array. So he developed, together with Leutheusser and Yip, a theory for the Lorentz gas. And then he wanted to study supercooled liquids. And therefore, Alf invited him simply.
Okay, so Alf and Professor Goetze knew of each other. They had met many. Okay.
So, as I said, Goetze had been at our institute for maybe some seminar or some shorter period. We had in 73, there was a Nobel symposium in Göteborg. Mm-hmm. And he was there for a few days and visited that symposium.
So during his stay, the two of you co-authored an article on the mode coupling theory, Dynamics of Spin Glasses. Can you walk us through the genesis of that work?
Yeah, the idea was to understand the neutron scattering data, which existed by Metsay and co-workers, try to understand. And then we already thought maybe it's the same cause as structure glasses. So it's a dynamical transition. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to understand. There was also a paper by Anderson and Edwards Anderson, where they started from a dynamical description studied spin glasses from a dynamical description. So it was in these lines, I think we thought in these lines. Later we understood that spin glasses is more complicated than that, that there are more detailed interactions than in structural glasses.
So were you aware at the time you started of the work of Sampolinsky and Zipelius that were also trying to establish a dynamical theory of spin glasses? And if yes, how influential were their work in your thinking and in the field at that time?
Sipelius was a student to Goetze, so of course we knew these results. But I don't know if they influenced us so much, except that we discussed, you know, there were also some works with Hertz, which were similar in a certain sense. So we discussed all, of course, these works.
With John, no, you said you discussed with John Hertz a little later.
Yeah, that was later. We had then finished our own paper. Okay. But we invited him to discuss with him. Yes. He was then at Nordita. Mm-hmm. So it was only he could come to Göteborg simply.
So during his stay, Professor Goetze also worked with Professor Olanda and a PhD student, Ulf Bengtzelius, on the mode coupling theory of liquids. In notes you sent us, and just before, you mentioned that Professor Olanda and you had been thinking about supercooled liquids for some time already, almost 5 years. Yeah. What was the conceptual hurdle that prevented progress up until that interaction? What did getting together sort of unlock?
What do you mean?
So you had been interested in this project for 5 years, but it's only, it seems, with the visit of Professor Goetze that progress or significant advances were made. What was enabled by this visit, or what new idea came about?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I went to Paris and worked with Jean-Pierre Hansen on plasmas. And then after I returned to Sweden, I was in Göteborg for 1 year working on molten salts and such problems. Which was in a certain respect a continuation of the plasma works. But then I left for the industry. And then of course, Professor Sjölander, he made some work together with Turski, Lukasz Turski from Poland, but in a very phenomenological way by some hopping model. And then I think the real work started when Ulf Bengtselius, when he got his student Ulf Bengtselius, who started with our equations then, going back to these equations, mode coupling equations. And they, Alf and Ulf, they had maybe been working for 1 year or so before Götze joined.
Mm.
So in a certain sense, they had some understanding. So actually, when Götze joined us, he thought that the glass transition was like in the Lorentz model, you know, a continuous transition. But Alf realized that it was a discontinuous transition. So he had to convince Götze that it was a discontinuous transition. But then Götze was very clever, so he was able to make a lot of progress together with Alf and Ulf.
So a paper on the mode coupling theory of glasses came out at roughly the same time as the paper by Alf and Ulf, but this written by Eberhard Leuthäuser.
Yeah.
What was there? Could we say that there was a race to the mode coupling theory of glasses at the time, or this was completely independent events?
Yeah, of course, Leuthäuser was a student to Götze, and they had discussed and they worked on this Lorentz model together with Diep. And then Leuthäuser went to the United States and worked with Diep. And while they were working on the Lorentz model, they also discussed how to apply it to real glasses and to try to understand it. And I don't know precisely, you know, I suppose it was independent. I mean, Leuthäuser made his work when he was in the United States, and Alf and Ulf Bengtselius has started in Sweden. And so they both came to the same conclusion that it must be a discontinuous transition. But I don't know how the discussion went while Leuthäuser was in Götze's group, if they, you know, how they thought. I don't know that, mm-hmm. really.
So after that visit, you went to TU München for some time to work on the mode coupling theory of glasses with Professor Götze, right?
Yeah.
And how did this visit come about? What was the idea?
Well, he asked me if I wanted to come to Munich. So he applied for money. And first he, there was also the question if he should, he was offered, I think, some position at some other university, but this did not realize. And it took some time before he got some money, but eventually got some money to invite me. So then I came there in 85 and stayed 1 year.
Was there a particular project the two of you wanted to work on, or was it continuing this thin glass work, or what was the idea behind your visit?
No, the spin glass work, I think we left. You know, he discussed with this Fisher, who was an expert. And then we realized that spin glasses are more complicated systems. So we decided to stay at structural losses and try to understand try to develop more of this theory simply. And so we started actually to study the alpha relaxation. So we did some numerical works on these simplified models. And then came this work by Das and Masenko while I was there. And then I realized that this was precisely what we had did in liquids, you know, coupling to the currents. So we simply took more or less this theory, which we had developed. And then we worked out what are the consequences of this additional term, this delta term. So we found this this scenario, so to speak. So I think this was very essential to understand what the glass transition is all about. There is some underlying singularity which is never reached, but depending on how close you come to this singularity, you can see different effects. And then there are this non-trivial dynamical scenario in this region. And we also made some calculations where we included this so-called hopping term to see if it could work numerically. But that was still on these simplified models.
So can you describe how your collaboration functioned? In particular, how were your two expertises complementary in this effort?
Yeah, I mean, Götz has a very good mathematical background, obviously. So we were both working independently, more or less, and then we discussed more or less every day. And he did some, he came to some conclusions, and I came to some conclusions. So this, this is how it worked.
So once you agreed, you published.
And then there were occasions. I remember especially one occasion, but that was later in 88. I write about that in the notes. There was also one occasion in 85 when I was in Munich, because we did not understand this scaling law. It's a two-parameter scaling law, and it was a very complicated scenario, I think. You know, that window which opened around the singularity. But that Götz was at home and thinking, and then he presented more or less this result. And then we worked out all details, so to speak. But I remember a similar, that was in 88. We were discussing then the higher order singularities, the cusps. And we did not understand how, and we saw from the numerical results that there are logarithmic terms, but we did not understand how can you get logarithmic terms from our equations. After all, if you start from Newton's equations, well, it's similar, of course, to these scale to these power laws which we get. There are no power laws in Newton's equations. They are regular, so to speak. So how do you get these power laws? And it was even more difficult maybe to understand how you get these logarithmic terms. But then we guessed maybe it's powers of log t, or maybe the critical spectrum is 1 over log t to some power. And then we checked it with the spin loss data, which we had by Metsay and co-workers. And then we found that it fitted perfectly with a 1 over log t squared. So this was, there were certain breakthroughs. So then I went home and tried an ansatz. I tried a function of log t and tried to determine this unknown function. And this gave these elliptic functions as a solution. And then I know Götze later, together with some student, he showed he could find the power laws in log t and various power laws in log t.
So you've mentioned numerical work as inspiring a lot of your analytical developments. Can you describe what sort of techniques and what sort of computational resources you had at your disposal to do this numerical work?
Yeah, I had done a lot of numerical work in my thesis work. So I solved the mode coupling equations for liquids and compared with neutron scattering and molecular dynamics simulations. So I simply took the same kind of programs and applied it to these schematic models. I work mostly with schematic models. Ulf Bengtzelius also solved the, so he got my programs and solved for the full equations. But the schematic models were very rewarding because they were all the simple and you could easily get out results. Götze also developed a numerical technique, which we then implemented. But that was later, I think, yeah. So I Laplace transformed the equations and solved them in Laplace transform space or in Fourier space. Mm-hmm. And then I inverted and then I iterated, so to speak. So you start with some exponential function and then you iterate until you get the convergence.
And these computers, these were sort of desktop or university computers you could use to do that?
It was university computers at that time, yeah.
Okay.
At that time, desktop computers were not so effective. So you went, you actually had a pile of cards. but in Munich, you had a terminal, okay. But in my PhD work, I had, punching cards and had to wait one day before you get results. Actually, my advisor, Alf Kolander, he also made a lot of numerical work back in the time when there were no computers. There were two computers in Sweden called BARC and BESC, which had been constructed by some fellow who had been at IBM in United States and then returned. And at that time, they didn't even have cards. They had some paper, what do you call it? a roll of paper which they punched with the holes. But he was one of the first actually to do numerical computations in Sweden. And his computations are in the book by Lovesey and Marshall about neutron scattering.
So what was the initial reaction of the community to the mode coupling theory of glasses?
Yeah, it was very, there were two kinds of reactions. So many theoreticians were very skeptical, in particular in United States, but also some in Europe. While the experimentalists were very pleased because they could they got the theory which they could use to compare, analyze their experiments. But as I so write in my notes, even the experimentalists, so we had there was a strong opposition, I would say, in the early years. I remember this conference in Crete where some people were very upset and shouted at us. But the experimentalists also, some experimentalists also faced opposition when they used the theory to analyze their work. So some got very strange referee reports.
So in the notes you sent us, you mentioned that one of the criticism of the mode coupling theory singularity is that it could not exist because hopping processes were neglected. And you've mentioned those. Was this obvious from the start? And if not, when did the realization sink in that this was...
This was obvious from the start, as I also wrote right in my notes, because we already had these currents. It was just that the argument was, let's forget about this from the start to see what if we can study the ideal case first. But then we realized that there are, of course, hopping. It's known from solid state also that you have these kind of hopping processes in solids. So you have diffusion in solids. So in particular, Alf Sjölander, who had worked on solids, you know, he knew all this. And of course, Götze also knew all this. So. But it's true that was an argument against the theory from the start. In particular, then there was a paper by Sidja, I think, who was very influential in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So if we fast forward a couple of years in time, at some point, the colloidal hard spheres became a very important theme for mode coupling theory research, especially after the work of Van Meegen and co-workers. Can you walk us through how that interaction between mode coupling theory and colloidal hard spheres came about? What motivated what, and how did the discussions were taking place?
Yeah, we started to look for experiments, you know, up to say maybe 88 or so. There were mostly computations, computer, or we sold the schematic models on the computer, but there were no really experiments where we had been able to test the theory. But somehow Götze got in contact with Pusey. He probably met Pusey at some conference. And they started, so Götze, I suppose, suggested that we should analyze their experiments. And we had some cooperation, so we analyzed, they also analyzed their experiments. So we had some meetings with QC and Vermeegen, and they learned how what the theory was about. And then we made a joint analyzing of their experiments, but they published one experimental paper and we published one theoretical paper, but there were two actually joint papers. They appeared in the same issue after each other. And of course, we offered Pius and Vermeegen to also have their names on our paper, but they thought it was better, you know, to have two papers.
I see.
But that was really, I mean, the point was also that since they essentially studied a hard sphere system, and for hard spheres, you could, you knew all, in fact, you know, knew the structure factor and you could evaluate the mode coupling integrals. So therefore, it was possible to actually make comparisons without any parameters. So this was the big interest, that here you have experiments which you, and there are no parameters in the theory except for this overall time scale. So it was, I think, a real success. It was, in a certain sense, a benchmark experiment for the theory.
So would it be fair to say that this was a breakthrough for the theory? People looked at it differently after that work, or did it, was, how was the reaction after that?
I think, some experimentalists probably, there were probably a breakthrough because, we got contact with Cummins and Leudel and Dunkenheimer started. There were also other groups. I remember I was at a ski conference in Switzerland, you know, where you ski in the daytime and then you have a conference in the evening. That was in a small village in Switzerland. But then I didn't like to ski, or I wasn't a very good skier, at least not in downhill. So I thought I'd go to the nearby village with a bus. And on the bus, I met some other guy also visiting the conference, Franz Fujara. So we went to this village, but it was not so good weather, so we went to some cafe, had some coffee, and I explained the theory to him, but what it was all about. And then later, I met him at some other conference, and he told me that after we met the first time, he applied for money and started to do experiments. And he did a lot of experiments on the mode coupling theory. And I think he himself also interested other people. He came from Mainz. So he interested other people. So it spread. Somehow spread around. That this was an interesting theory.
In 1992, you co-wrote a major review of what was called the relaxation processes in supercooled liquids. Why was this a good moment to write a review of the work in your mind?
Somehow we felt that we had come to some point where we understood the problem. And I think that there also came some suggestion. Got some suggestion to write a review, I think. Actually from another journal. So I got an offer, I suppose, from both two journals. And then we thought that this was the best journal. But maybe it was also we thought there was still, you know, this opposition. I think this opposition is still present even today, actually. So to write a review was a good thing if you want to spread the ideas or explain the theory in a, say, more simple ways to make it more readable.
In that review, you mentioned that the work of Kirkpatrick, Thermalay, and Wolness had proposed a unification of the mode coupling theory of glasses with the thermodynamic description of disordered solids under a theory that was actually derived from spin glass work, right, on Potts glasses. Yeah. And this relationship was also mentioned in Professor Goetz's notes for the Lesouch lecture. How much attention did you pay to that proposal at the time? And can you describe its impact, if it had any?
I don't know if I have any direct memories. I think the... they had some, there were some interesting ideas which they had. They got several transition temperatures, I remember, which we discussed. But Kirkpatrick also made some work on real glass or ordinary glasses. So this probably. We probably discussed this more than the spin glasses. I don't remember this very well, I must say.
Did you interact with them or with Kirkpatrick in those years at all, or was this completely...
Yeah, we met Kirkpatrick in Fukuyama or Fukuoka or in Japan. I think it was Fukuoka so Kawasaki organized a conference in Fukuoka, and there was Kirkpatrick, and then we discussed with him. So we went out having dinner and so on. And then at that conference, he also discussed the spin glass Potts model. Yeah.
A few years later, you essentially left the field of structural glasses, if I understood correctly. Was there a drive for leaving at that time? And what impact did your work on the mode coupling theory of glasses had on the rest of your research after that?
I left. I was involved in a lot of administration and teaching. I had very little time for research, especially after, say, 2000. So most of my time was teaching, or I was what is called a vice dean for some years. and also the head of the department for some years. So I would say after 2000, I could not really follow the development. But I actually read, I found your paper here with Reichman from 2005. Was this at some kind of summer school or?
Yes, yes. These were notes that Professor Reichman taught at a summer school, and I helped him flesh out into an article.
Do you know that you taught them mumbo jumbo?
I was a graduate student. I did not need a teaching. I helped with the writing up.
Ah, okay.
So at Chalmers or elsewhere, did you ever teach about the mode coupling theory of glasses? And if yes, can you detail your experience?
Yeah, I had a course in, it was most a course in stochastic processes in physics, chemistry, and biology, it was said. And there I had a chapter on colloids. So and you start with the Fokker-Planck equation. And then I used the mode coupling approximation and went through these experiments on colloids. Yeah, so this was where I taught mode coupling, I can say.
So what years would this have been, roughly?
Maybe from 2000 it could have been from 2000 or something. We started with there was this Bologna structure. You first have a Bachelor of Science and then the Master of Science. So then we started these master programs around 2000. And then I had this course in stochastic processes. But this was this course was more, it was about Langevin equation, Fokker-Planck equations, and Brownian motion and these kind of things.
So before my lecture notes, which you brought up, there was a lecture notes published by Professor Goetze following the Lesueur school in 91. Yeah, yeah. The 89 school, but published in 91. How impactful was the Lesueur school and the notes for the pedagogy of the mode coupling theory in the world?
Yeah, of course, they were very detailed. Goetze is this kind of traditional German, very detailed. But I think many people prefer to read our review article because they think it's simpler. I don't know. But if you read Goetze's book, you understand that he has put some effort to make the theory rigorous, so to speak. And I think this is this was also his ambition in these Lesueur lectures. So in this sense, they are very helpful if you want to know the detailed structure of the theory.
Yeah, you mentioned in your notes, and here again in this response, the importance of rigor in in mathematical rigor. How important was this? Mostly self-driven, meaning that this is what Professor Goetze wanted to achieve, or this was in response to criticism, or this was just a goal in general of the community? What was the...
No, I think that was our common interest, you know. So I think I brought it up that we should write a rigorous mathematical paper, actually proving our theorems, what we could prove. So even, you know, since I was in München in 85, we then proved that the solution to our equations were monotonic functions. And then we thought maybe it's even a completely monotonic function, you know, a superposition of exponentials. And so we wanted to prove these kind of things, you know, that the solution, first of all, that the solution exists, but that's more straightforward. And then some rigorous properties, for instance, that it is completely monotonic, that we understand that there is a bifurcation scenario, irrespective if you like it or not, it just falls out, so to speak. And I think this is what people who are against the theory did not understand, that there is a bifurcation in the equations. And this bifurcation gives this non-trivial relaxation. It was more maybe our personal interest. But it's always good to have exact results, I think.
So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed during the interview?
No, I don't know.
Okay. So in closing then, do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
If you have
notes, papers, correspondence about these ideas from that epoch, and if do you still have them? And if yes, do you have plans to deposit them in an archive at some point?
I don't know. This is my letters from Goetze and other people. So do you think anybody's interested, or?
I think so, but I mean, for instance, do you know if Goetze, so a possible solution, and we can discuss this more after the recording, but one solution is if, for instance, Professor Goetze as a fond in the archive in Munich, you could deposit your letters along, these letters in particular, along to in his archival fond.
Yeah, I don't know. Do we have such archives, or where do you find such archives?
So it could be at the university. Usually, you'd be the university libraries at Munich. That would have established such but I understand mostly the answer. So let me thank you for this interview, and we'll carry on after the recording.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.